Good morning and welcome to WNHH-FM's Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make our community tick. New Haven is ticking, just like our state, just like our country, just like the world, about COVID-19, the latest coronavirus. We're ticking with questions. What's happening? What will happen? What should we do? What are decision makers going to do? Well, look no further, folks. We have two of the top people in city government on the front lines working on those questions every day, morning and night, pretty much every minute. And they're here to answer our questions. Say good morning to City of New Haven Health Director Maritza Bond and Mehul Dalal, the government's community service administrator. Welcome, folks.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Very nice to have you both on. Thank you for making time. You're busy. And I want to thank Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. So if you have any questions, I see Bob McCormick's already joined, send them in, and I'm going to start some questions in my mind. First of all, how are you folks doing, the two of you? Are you staying healthy, and what are you doing around the clock?
So as you might imagine, we are wrapped up in a major way in coronavirus response activities.
And I was going to ask if you can get a little closer to the mic, maybe put it like facing you.
Sure thing.
Great.
Yeah, so we are working hard every day on planning in response to coronavirus. There's a lot of planning that goes on behind the scenes. There's a lot of information to keep up with. So both Director Bond and I try to stay up to date on the latest information coming in from the CDC and coming in from the state.
That'd be the Centers for Disease Control.
That's correct, the Centers for Disease Control. And every day we wake up with potentially a new situation to handle, a new scenario that we have to deal with, a new guidance we have to get out, new populations that we have to consider. So thanks for asking how we are. We're very busy, but we're doing it for the protection of the residents.
Now, for instance, do you make sure that you get enough sleep so that you're not more vulnerable to getting the virus so you can run things? Or is it just a matter of time you can get in anyway so you just...
So absolutely. So in between all of this hard work on ensuring that we're protecting the health of our residents, we have to protect ourselves also. And so we're staying hydrated, eating. In between, I mean, we're even having lunch meetings. After this, we'll have a lunch meeting as we're strategizing for some of our upcoming events that we're planning. So absolutely, first, we have to take care of, self-care is critical as we are trying to send a message out to our residents.
I always say on an airplane, if you have a little kid, the first thing you do is you protect yourself so you can protect the little kid, right?
That's right.
So do you have, for instance, a daily meeting, you said, about COVID?
Daily meetings. Internally, we are also having external communications that are weekly with our partners, both at a national, state, and local level. We're trying to ensure that we have open communications with all of those entities that are really involved in trying to mitigate this virus, because it's so critical that as things are evolving as quickly as it is, that we're all on the same page. And also sending consistent messaging.
And it's a big deal. So yesterday afternoon, you got the message from the governor say, hey, we'd like you not to have gatherings with more than 100 people at them. I went to one last night at our synagogue. It was the holiday of Purim, and I thought there wouldn't be many people there, but there were hundreds of people there, kids in costumes and stuff. I don't know how much longer that's going to go on.
Did you have social distancing?
We did not. People, not too many people were hugging. We had hand sanitizer.
Okay.
But it's probably not going to be too much longer that we have events like that, right? Like, what are you going to do about religious events?
You know, we actually have a faith-based meeting this evening at 7 o'clock.
Where is that going to be?
At the Yale Divinity School. And we're going to talk a little bit about that and taking some precautions. We obviously want to make sure that, people are not panicked, but are just being prepared. This is not the first type of outbreak that we've had to experience in our country. And so we are. It's important for people to be informed of the facts and not the myths. And then be able to make viable decisions and be socially responsible as they are moving about their day-to-day.
People are not panicked, but prepared. The mission of New Haven Health Director Maritza Bond and Community Service Administrator Mehul Dalal. They're here answering your questions. The first one comes from Bob. And by the way, where is that a public meeting at 7 p.m. for people of congregations?
I believe it was an invitation meeting to faith leaders.
Faith leaders. Well, that's important. Yeah. I mean, wow. Bob asks, why is it that young kids are not getting the coronavirus? And is it possible that New Haven schools will close for a while? Thank you for the question, Bob.
Yeah, I'll take the question about the virus itself. So there's some things we know and some things we don't know about the virus. what we have strong evidence for, if young kids are getting the virus, their symptoms tend to be very mild, and they are less likely to be suffering from severe consequences from the virus.
That's a great thing. Would you mind if I ask you to turn the mic facing you?
This way, right?
Excellent.
Okay. Boy,
there it is. Not going to hear you.
Now, so that's the good news for the kids. One of the issues from a disease spread standpoint where that's challenging is that if kids have milder symptoms that may not be detected or may not be known, then they can serve as sources of transmission to individuals who are at higher risk, such as older individuals and those with chronic health conditions. So it may not be the case that kids are not getting the disease, but they may be getting very mild cases and they may be going undetected.
Is that if, or are we just assuming that?
We are assuming that at this point. There's still a lot that's not known.
The Board of Education talked about it. There was a teacher who's been pressing one issue. Her name's Tony Coscolo, saying parents are sending their kids sick to work. They sometimes feel they can't afford not to. Is that going to make it spread faster?
You mean sick to school, not work, right?
I meant work. School. Sorry about that. Yeah.
We are encouraging and we are working closely, actually, with our local superintendent. She's an amazing leader along with her team to ensure strategies on obviously preventing faculty and also the children. We are encouraging the general public, including parents that have sick children, to really, if they're running a high fever, if they're displaying respiratory illnesses, that they really should stay home. I mean, that's just the standard protocol, whether this virus was in existence or not, right? And so they are encouraged, if they become too ill, they should go to the school nurse, be assessed, and then the parent will need to make the necessary arrangements.
And I have noticed that part of what this is about for me personally is doing things I should have done for the first 60 years of my life. Like, this is the first time I'm washing my hands well. And then I watched, the New York Times had that diagram of when you wash your hands, what you miss. I never thought before about thumbs. They say nobody ever cleans their thumbs.
You know, Paul, that's a great point. We've been seeing memes and songs being created about hand washing. And believe it or not, that is the main prevention of just basic.
That's how I started. Babs Rose Ivy has a show this in early morning. Yeah. Before this, it was the flu. She had a song she sings when she does the flu, and now I sing that every day.
Yeah, some of these memes.
Do you want to sing it right now?
Yeah, sing one.
No, I can't sing.
She was just that birthday.
You'll kick
happy
me off the air.
No, I won't. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, special person. Wash your hands so you don't get the flu. But I do it a little short.
Do it twice. Yeah, you get to do it twice.
Or shorter, because Justin Ellicker told me that it has to be 20 seconds, right?
20
seconds.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's
you
right.
You got a happy birthday twice. The memes and the jokes are sometimes spreading quicker than the virus. I have two kids in the public school system, and they come back with a different meme or a joke every day. But to add to Maritza's points about school keeping kids home when they're sick, that's a serious point, because we really do need to be stepping up our precautions. Part of stepping up our precautions is really asking the business community to step up. They have to review their leave policies, make sure they're as generous as they can possibly be, clarify those policies for the employees and the employee supervisors. The employees should not be coming in if they're sick. And if the employees have to take care of children at home, if they are asked to stay home because they're sick, or if some other issue happens, like school closures that was mentioned by the person who asked the question, we really have to ask our business community to step up. We understand that the economy is important, but we do have to ask them to step up, to be generous with their policies, to clarify those policies, and encourage people to stay home if they shouldn't be coming to work and coming into contact with people. That's
so
a serious point.
We've done is, so Harry George, our station manager, as we speak, is developing a technique so that we can do radio remotely. I've told everyone who works for me, you're fully paid, fully covered. If the second you want to not come in, don't come in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you're asking people to do. Question, what is the most common myth you have seen circulating about COVID-19? And what is the most... Oh, before we get to that, the other part of his question is, will schools close? I mean, should we be ready? The colleges are starting to go online. Do you think where it's likely that New Haven Public Schools will close and or be online?
We are convening daily with the superintendent and her leadership team. They are developing curriculum should they have closures, but they're also looking at the severity of this issue, right? We have a multitude of things that we have to take into consideration. We have individuals with persons with disabilities, children with disabilities that we have to think about. We have to think about how do they get access to food. We have people that are low income.
Sometimes their only meal, the kids.
So
United Way, I believe, we have a story this morning in The Independent. Chris Peake wrote about the meeting last night, the board ad, where they said that United Way is working with you folks to make sure people get schools. But does that mean we're expecting at some point the schools will close?
We are planning for the unknown. And so it is important that we prepare. And so for every possible scenario, we are, the mayor and part of our leadership team are coming up with, thinking about different scenarios and having a plan in the event that we need to respond to an emergency.
I would say that there is a possibility. It would depend on the scenario. We would consider the public health scenario very carefully before making the decision. We wouldn't make the decision lightly, but there would have to be a strong public health justification for something like that to happen. It is important for parents to prepare for that possibility. Mm-hmm. That's another message I'd really like to get out there. It's not easy to have your kid from. I know I have kids in school in the New Haven public school system. Two parents working. It is not easy, but it is important to think through the possibility what you would do if the child's school does have to be dismissed.
What are you guys
for a period
gonna
of time?
What's your plan?
Well, luckily we have my father in the area that's able
Excellent.
To come in and help out.
But you know, that's not a little thing.
Yeah,
a lot of people are going to be relying on family.
Yeah,
that's actually a huge thing, and not everybody has that. But a lot.
I consider myself very lucky to have that resource available. Everyone has to think about their individual plan as to what they're going to do.
Yeah,
I think in addition, it's really to Dr. DeLaw's point, is really getting your household ready. And so we developed what you need to know and published them on the website, and they've been posted on social media outlets so that families can prepare the household in the event that they have to remain in the homes for an extended period of time.
Now, you said, I see things that say 2 weeks, 4 weeks. I bought like, I'd say 2-3 weeks of non-perishable groceries.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? You on four? What do you think?
Well, right now, the self-isolation protocol that the Center for Disease Control has put out there is 14 days. So the event that you need to be home for 14 days is a safe starting point. But some people may have to stay in the home a longer period of time for recovery.
But will other people be able to go get them food? Will gig workers be working out there and exposing themselves to the virus and delivering food to you? I mean, what do you see?
We are looking at we are ensuring that businesses have their plan also, so safeguarding their employees. And so we also put out a what you need to know for businesses
mm-hmm.
to safeguarding their employees as well, because there is the potential of risk if you're going to be delivering groceries, because I know that that's a method for some people, not all people. And then in addition to that, to your point, with United Way, we are trying to develop a mechanism that in the event that we need to provide access to food for those vulnerable populations that don't readily have groceries for that length of time in their homes.
All right. Well, we're talking about myths and reality, and any questions you might have about coronavirus, COVID-19. Did I pronounce it right? COVID?
That's correct.
All right.
Give us a call.
We're talking about that with City New Haven Health Director Maritza Bond and Mehul Dalal, the government's community service administrator. So let's get back to that second question. What is the most common myth you have seen circulating about COVID-19? And what is the most effective precaution New Haveners can take to protect themselves?
I can start out with a myth that I've heard. I don't know if it's the most common, but I think it relates to a really important issue around COVID-19. Is the myth that are certain races and ethnicities and populations that are more susceptible than others. I haven't heard a lot of this happening in New Haven, but I have heard of it happening on the news nationwide. The stigmatization of individuals potentially who are Asian ethnicities.
About that Monday at a conference.
I think this is an issue that we need to confront and talk about, because from a public health response standpoint, we do not want individuals to feel afraid of coming forward if they have symptoms. This is public health 101. If they have symptoms, they should be feeling comfortable coming forward. Those individuals that are engaged in stigmatization are actually causing public health risk. So I think this piece is very important. We have to avoid stigmatization. What we know about the disease is that anyone can be impacted, anyone can get the disease, anyone can transmit the disease. There is not a specific race or ethnic profile to this disease. The other piece is that I've heard and have been disturbed by is the scapegoating of more vulnerable populations, such as the homeless populations. Mm. Again, they are not thought to be at additional risk in terms of being the transmitters of the disease. We have to treat them as individuals and as we would any population with respect to risk of having
COVID.
The first
person who sprayed and got me to use hand sanitizer is a homeless man. He's an activist in town. He saw me on Friday, and we were just trying to get in our minds around what to think about all this that day. Mm-hmm. So he put out his hand, and I shook it. Then he put out some hand sanitizer and squirted us both and said, you got to be careful.
That's great.
I love it.
The word has got to get out there for everybody. I think that's fantastic.
So the word here, the question is, do you think we're panicking too much? And let me ask that more broadly. I want to give you two exaggerated views that I think a lot of us are actually ping-ponging between every day. For me, it's a factor of where you're sitting around not doing much and freaking out about everything you're hearing, or then you go about your day-to-day life and you're not seeing coronavirus in front of your eyes that you're seeing what's everybody panicking about. Mm-hmm. It's according to one school of thought, this is the flu. Mm-hmm. Flu kills 30,000 people. I think that might be the number every year. Mm-hmm. As with all kinds of flus, older people are more vulnerable, people with autoimmune problems, and that if we didn't want any of them to die, we would always just stop it from spreading by quarantine. But in fact, most people don't die from it. We just have it go through our population, and we do have to wash our hands and be careful. Then the other view is this is different. This is spreading faster. It's much more lethal. And that even if it is eventually going to hit us, there's a public health imperative to stop the slow so we're not overwhelmed because we're not prepared in our hospitals, that this is different from other coronaviruses and other flus. That this is not just the swine flu.
Yeah, so for us at the health department, we call it the Fight the Flu campaign. And we're always promoting the flu vaccines. I mean, we even have it readily available. I mean, you can go to Walgreens to the grocery store and get a flu vaccine.
That's where I get mine, CVS.
CVS. And yeah. And so where did I get mine? My primary doctor. And it's often free and covered by your insurance as a preventative mechanism. And so with the flu, it's very tangible that you can try to at least preventing from getting the severity of the flu, although it doesn't cover all strains of it. But there's a vaccine out there. COVID-19, novel coronavirus, does not have a vaccine. And so it makes it a greater risk factor for those that can come in contact with it. And to your point, yes, those currently with coming back with cases are elderly persons, older people, and those with pre-existing conditions. And so we want to make sure that, and those individuals are also around children and around other populations. They're not an isolated group. They're just the most vulnerable currently coming back positive cases.
So the question was really from people, are we overreacting? Is this just like any other flu that comes? You're saying one difference is no vaccine, so it might hit more people. I'm getting the sense there's more to it. Is it deadlier?
I think it is different from the regular flu, for sure. As Director Bond said, the vaccine piece is one of it. We don't have a vaccine for this. One of the pieces of science that is evolving on this, since this is such a new virus, remember, it feels like a lifetime for some people, especially for those in the field working on this every day. But we just identified it late last year in 2019. So,
and this came from animals used in the food industry in China, right?
The thought is that it originated in bats, and then that transmitted to potentially other animals and then onto humans. But the one piece of, there's many pieces of information from a scientific standpoint we need to find. But to answer your question about overreaction versus underreaction, it's hard to know. And I can understand why people have anxieties, because even the scientific community doesn't have the information to know what to communicate about this. The reason is we don't know the case fatality rate. What that means is of the number of people who get the disease, how many are actually going
to
die?
I wanted to get in the weeds like that with you, because they are saying things like 10 times as many people, but we have a sense that so many people haven't, we don't know it.
Right.
So if 10 times as many people have it, then we think that would be the same fatality rate. However, it's also true that often people have been exposed to flu and we don't know it.
Yeah.
So what's the deal on that?
So, the reason why that severity index of case fatality is so important, that guides our public health response. So if it was a high fatality rate, a high severity of disease, we are more comfortable doing much more aggressive public health measures. We mentioned school closures earlier. We mentioned social distancing. We mentioned event count. We've gone down partway down that path. In terms of parsing that number, we need to know the total number of people who have the disease, which we simply do not know at this point because testing is not widely available.
So in Italy, a lot of people are dying, right? What was the number there? They're in the tens of thousands, though?
No, not that many people.
Italy is a little bit over confirmed cases, over 9,000.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Just confirmed cases. And then the fatalities is not as... I'm looking it up right now. So
they said the Times morning has as much as the rest of Europe combined, I think, in the fatalities.
They do have a lot of deaths.
And they're on lockdown.
Yeah, and it's some speculation as to why that is. It might be an older population. They may have more chronic diseases.
Correct.
There might be a higher prevalence of smoking.
Is smoking? It just makes you less able to deal with it.
It's your lungs. Your lungs are.
Oh, because it's respiratory.
Yeah, again, this is speculative. We don't know that it's a respiratory illness, so it would stand to reason that if you're a smoker, that your lungs would have a weaker capacity to withstand the disease.
Yeah, there's current 463 fatalities in Italy.
Oh, I was way off. See that? How for misinformation spreads? You read something and you miss it?
Yeah.
That's okay. That's why we're here.
That's why you're here. And who we are is Senior Haven Health Director Maritza Bonn and Mehul Dalal, the government's community service ministry here on Dateline New Haven, 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. If you're on our Facebook page, you can see that Gage Frank, thank you, posted that Italy has 9,000 cases and just under 500
deaths.
Thank
you, Gage.
So as usual, since I'm in the media, I misrepresented, exaggerated by about 50 times, but we're giving you facts here. And if you go to the Facebook, New Haven Independent Facebook page, and you're watching this, you'll see the link from Gage, and you can post your own question as well. Public meetings. Mm-hmm. So how much are you preparing and how quickly for government to go online? I was at the city clerk's. I was at 200 Orange Street this morning, city office building. Fewer people than usual from the public are coming in and out, but everyone's at work, it seems like, unless they're sick.
We are working.
Will we be interacting with government virtually? Is there a plan for that? What's going to happen if you have to record deeds, if you have to, you're just going to wait it out, or how's that going to work?
We are actually, plans are underway right now. We don't have, there's a lot of policies and laws and regulations to work through to make that happen. For example, FOIA and whatnot. So we have people within our city leadership that are working through those questions and issues, assuming as we speak, really, because we met this morning and identified as an issue that we would have to achieve clarification
on. So I guess you can't really
on.
Tell us, like, on this date, we're going to do that because you're waiting. So let's talk about what would make that possible. What do you have to be seeing? You talked about the fatality rate. When you're looking at if you're going to have to kick into gear to make government more virtual, what are the markers that you're going to have to see?
The markers are essential versus non-essential employees. And so really who are going to be the critical workforce responding to this emergency?
Like the cops, the cops are going to have to be out, right?
Oh, absolutely. So our first responders are a priority for us, ensuring that they're equipped and ready to respond. And they are, along with our public health team.
Do you have special training for them or equipment for the police and fire?
They are all properly equipped. There's a few additional, extra measures that they, have ordered. So for example, the fire department just ordered, a new way to take temperature at least 10 feet away, which is a nice, safe social distance.
How do they do that?
So they're going to be ordering an equipment that can literally digitalize and sense someone's temperature from 10 feet away.
That's so interesting.
That's pretty cool. I was really excited to hear about the new technology that they have.
Yeah, Paul, they use that in pizza shops too, where they check the oven temperature from a distance.
So is that how
same it was technology
developed? Was the technology adapted for that?
I don't know what direction it went in, but
we're just joking.
maybe New Haven will be on the map again for its pizza technology informing COVID response, right? All joking.
But anyway, so that's one example. You got the fire department. First of all, they're going to be out there. So one thing you're doing is you're enabling them to take temperature from a distance.
Yes, absolutely.
How about cops?
And so the cops, when they're responding to emergencies, we have a process in place. If they are filtering the call through the 911 dispatcher, just kind of making sure that They're pre-screening those calls, inquiries that are coming in for potential individuals, displaying those symptoms or expressing those symptoms. My team is part of that internal process where they will call and say, you know, we have a potential exposure. This is what they're saying. And we kind of filter and gauge that because people are not able to distinguish a common cold versus the risk factors of coronavirus. And so we work collectively together and have been working collectively together to ensure that there is no potential exposure to our first responders.
Right. And then you notice in the Times this morning, they had a story about New York. The health department workers are knocking on people's doors and slipping papers under the door about whether they have to be quarantined or if they need to go in for a test. Do you have outreach workers doing anything like that?
Our business partner, we have, we're going to be really communicating to the businesses. Right now, we don't have a positive case, and so mm-hmm. we don't have an outreach team necessarily. What we've been putting out is really through social media, traditional media, because we're in the mitigation phase, which means we're really trying to decrease social gatherings of 100 plus and more people.
So the big decision you made yesterday was no St. Patrick's Day parade.
Yes, yeah. That was a hard decision. I was looking forward to, and we'll have it. We're postponing it, not canceling.
<All right. laughs> So Crystal Heron writes, thanks, Crystal, for weighing in. I'm trying to read it because it's at a distance.
Is Trump right? Once it gets warmer, would this go away?
And then there was an early one, is the mild winter adding to this? Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of those questions that is part of the scientific uncertainty. We don't know whether the warmer weather will help mitigate the spread of coronavirus. If it behaves like the flu, it may have a seasonal component to it. And as people, you know, stay indoors less and go out more, there might be a mitigation effect. But that is speculation. We don't know that yet. The data is still coming in. The data is still being analyzed on whether or not that would actually be the case.
But presumably these things go in waves, right? At some point, it reaches a point either because so many people have been exposed and it goes down, or does it actually weaken?
It could weaken the trans. So if the genetic profile of the virus changes, which often that happens, and it reduces what they call the transmissibility, which is the likelihood it'll go from one person to the other. That's one possibility of how the epidemic might quell. Another possibility I mentioned was there might be a seasonal variation to it. The other possibility is that, and I don't like to think about this, but really this is a real public health scenario, is if it becomes very widespread and more than 50 to 60% of the population have come down with it, we would anticipate they would develop immunity. And then you have the herd immunity effect, where enough people are no longer transmitting the disease or don't get the disease or the infection, and then the epidemic quells in that fashion.
How likely is that?
It is still unknown.
Yeah.
And so each day we are monitoring the Center for Disease Control guidelines, speaking with our partners on a national and state and local level just to make sure that we are abreast of the latest information, because we do rely on the Center for Disease Control to give us guidance.
And we're relying for guidance today on Dateline New Haven, WNHH-FM, your home for community radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed, newhavenimpen.org. We got City New Haven Health Director Mirza Bond and Mehul Dalal, the government's community service administrator, answering questions such as this one. What do you think of wearing masks?
So we talk about this daily. The masks that we are encouraging people to wear are people that are actually sick, prevent from becoming sicker, but we're really discouraging. We've been seeing a fluctuation of people sending their kids with masks on that are not sick, or people just in the public. I've been just driving through downtown New Haven and seeing people with masks. It's really not a protective factor unless you are actually sick.
And we discourage
the use. It could be anything. It could be a chronic condition that you have.
And what kind of mask, and where do you get it? Can you even buy a mask?
You actually can.
Yeah, right. These would be commonly available masks. These are not specialized fitted masks that healthcare professionals use.
Now, what about those? What's up at the hospital? We've been reading about Bridgeport hospitals running out of masks. Hospitals all over the country are lacking basic supplies. At least I hope I have this one right, because I had Italy way wrong. all over the country, they say they're running out of supplies they need. What's the situation at Yale New Haven Hospital?
That is a reality across the state. We had a regional meeting just last week, and we have been all sharing information about inventory. We have been trying to really assess that. At the state level, they have a coalition collecting and tracking inventory at the statewide. So in the event that we have to respond in a specific area, then they will share those resources so that we can be equipped.
But what is the situation on the ground at Yale New Haven?
Well, I can't speak personally for Yale New Haven Hospital.
Because I'm sure you guys have been talking to them about their preparations. So what have you learned?
One of the things that we're learning is just like every other hospital across the state, they have supplies. They're still able to handle current day-to-day operations, and they are currently assessing ways that they can try to get a handle of additional supplies.
Have numbers been run, like if it hits New Haven and suddenly people are going to the hospital, how many people can they accommodate?
Yeah, so that's a Yale New Haven Hospital question that should be asked to the hospital.
Yeah, they do have capacity for surge, planning, including setting up a field hospital if necessary,
where
or a field care
be?
Site. Again, that would be a question for Yale New Haven Hospital. I don't have those details on hand.
Question: how does this compare to Ebola or the swine flu H1N1? Is it more deadly?
So, from what we know, it's very likely to be far, far less deadly than Ebola. Ebola was a high fatality condition. In the absence of treatment, I'm recalling numbers as high as 60, 70, 80%.
Mm-hmm.
With swine flu, from what we know so far, and this could change, it seems more serious than the swine flu. From what I recall, has ended up in circulation, but it is less harmful or less severe than what we know as COVID.
Again, spread because of we don't have a vaccine for it. Is that part of what that's about?
That's right. There's no vaccine for COVID-19. I understand that there are efforts away to quickly develop a vaccine. I don't anticipate that we'd see that in the coming months. Most ambitious estimates, I believe, are about a year and a half.
All right. So, Rodney Williams, if the virus is not detected for 5 days, how can you feel like everything is okay? We are not prepared for about to happen. We desire the truth. Time will tell. These questions should be able to be answered by those in charge. So I think what he's saying is that, is there a sleeping tiger here, given that there's a delay time between when it hits us? And isn't the answer that we are assuming that it could be here already? I mean, I think the mayor has repeatedly said, he says it's going to hit us. He said there's no question it's going to hit
us. It's just a matter of when. Rodney, you raise a good question.
True?
It's just a matter of when. And so, Rodney Williams, you
thank
raise
you for the question, Rodney.
And thank you for your question. You raise a really good question. And I think that's some of the things that we at the health department take really seriously. Those are the risk factors of exposure are the way that we are monitoring and interviewing individuals as part of our surveillance. We will, if you have a concern, if you've traveled in one of the countries that have these cases or one of the states that have positive cases, it's important that you share that information by contacting your healthcare provider immediately upon returning and then getting recommendations on whether or not you should be put in self-isolation, because you are correct. There are no symptoms and some symptoms can show up on day 12. And so that's why we have the 14-day cushion of remaining in the home.
And he says, Ronnie says, Yale was barely able to handle people with the flu. So one thing I want to ask you folks is about your personal experience in public health coming here and how that informs what you do today. So, Dr. Bond, you used to be the health director of the city of Bridgeport.
Correct.
That is the first place in Connecticut where there was a case. It was a doctor who worked there in Bridgeport Hospital. And now the person who lives in Connecticut, or the person in God, I believe, might not be at that hospital, might be at...
No, they're at Bridgeport Hospital also.
So mm-hmm. What would your day be like differently there? What would you be doing then if you were still in Bridgeport and then it might be happening here?
Yeah, we'll be pretty much doing similarly what we are doing now with perhaps now some additional precautions of determining some closures and things of that nature. So really moving on to the next phase. And so when we're talking about what has happened and transpired in China, for example, and talking about capacity about Yale, self-isolation is the way that they had to mitigate. And so because of the capacity issues, so people have to stay indoors.
And Yale, now they've canceled the big gatherings. UNH is going all virtual for the rest of the semester. Or not long,
for, no, the, for 2 weeks. A lot of the universities have transitioned for 2 weeks.
Columbia, Princeton's doing that. University of Washington, yeah.
So New York has declared a state of an emergency. Rhode Island has declared a state of an emergency. We have not here in Connecticut as of yet.
Once we do, is that a reason just to get more, be qualified for more aid, or is it going to affect our listeners in a day-to-day way? Once that state of emergency is declared, and I think that's a matter of time. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
No, it's a matter of time. It's
justifiable
for you to say.
So when that's declared, is that when schools are going to close? Is that when government meetings are going online?
So again, we will be looking at the positive cases of the individual and where the individual became positive. And so the setting. So it will be a case-by-case scenario on the situation. It's really a situational awareness of like, okay, what is the situation of the positive case? It was an elderly person. And so the risk exposure to that. So we really would need to look at the person that became positive.
And how would government function if it does go online? Like by statute, don't you have public meetings? We're passing a budget in the city. I know no one's thinking about the budget anymore.
Yeah, we have a public hearing tomorrow.
Right. So what would happen, what happens to those public meetings if that state of emergency is declared? Well, how's it going to work? Are people going to be able to send in questions, or Alder's still going to show up in a room with just three people and take questions or something this?
Yeah, I don't have the answer to that right now. I know our team, our operations team at City Hall are literally discussed that morning, and we're coming up with the plan for how that would work.
So there's no plan yet?
There isn't a...
For how virtual government will work. It's in the works.
It's in the works.
With the exception of the essential workers, I mean, we have a means already currently to telecommute if needed. We have a VOCI system to communicate online virtually. So we have a virtual coronavirus room.
Does that mean?
And so it's an emergency first responders and administration. All those working as the critical workforce to address this issue, we have a virtual means to communicate with each other.
Are you using Graywall for that? Or
is VOCI is the system,
yeah,
name
yeah,
of the
yeah,
system?
Graywall. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's called Graywall?
Well, that's the company that makes
VOCI. Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
So you say you have a plan in place for first responders, emergency worker, government. You're working out the details, if I understand correctly.
That's correct.
For how public meetings will work, how people doing things in government is going
to
work.
And we'll share it once we're ready to share that information. We'll obviously make it available.
Like I'm assuming, tell me if I'm wrong, the meeting schedule for this week are going to happen. So there's going to be a public hearing.
We're prepared for tomorrow.
Right. And what we are planning to do is informing anyone who's chairing the meetings to preamble those meetings information about precautions. So, you know, if someone happens to be at that meeting that's sick, what they should do if...
Leave.
That's probably what they should do. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, that's right, but, Paul. Let them know.
Right.
Yeah. And I think in addition for tomorrow, our strategy is really, it's a really large space. And so we're going to be asking people to sit, you know, have distance between seating. And then also as people... congregate and have their questions, they can feel free to leave so that we can manage the crowd control. Because of course we want to still be able to engage the public.
Well, I think we'll make a point at the Independent. We'll try to do that live.
Thank you.
So if you want to watch that hearing live, I'm going to ask. Yeah. I can't 100% promise, but we've done it in the past. So I'll ask a reporter going there if he can do that.
Thank you.
You know, it's this thing about budget meetings is that people talk about how much they hate taxes. But almost nobody shows up at a budget meeting. There are exceptions, but we've had years, we've had tax increases like this year where a total of 8 people show up to speak at the first public meeting. When we went to Hill House High, the last public budget hearing, there weren't many people speaking. So even if it weren't coronavirus, I'm guessing we're not going to have big turnout. I think the challenge for you folks might be, how do you preserve democracy when it's going to be hard for people to show up?
Yeah, well, looking on the potential bright side of this is this might accelerate our efforts to find solutions to virtual participation in our city government.
Definitely.
And that would be a potential good outcome of this is to have us think about creative ways for folks who participate, who normally don't participate.
And Rodney using technology. Williams writes,
3 weeks tops. Okay, this goes back to your point, Dr. Lal, about theories about racial impact, about which groups get hit. So he said 3 weeks tops, things will be shut down in our city to contain the virus. Why hasn't the minority community been affected by this virus? Or is it just a matter of time before it impacts all? So I'm Jewish, and in New York, it happened to be a synagogue, right? So it was a New Rochelle synagogue where it first spread and then spread out, and people weren't going to shul. So is Rodney right that this is a disease that seems to have certain groups in mind and not others?
That's a myth.
I haven't seen any data that would suggest that. So anybody is at risk if they're putting themselves at risk or if they're in close contact with someone who has a disease.
Exactly. Okay. No matter, regardless of race and socioeconomic status.
Okay, Dr. Malal, you've had such an interesting background as well, the both of you. You were the chronic disease director for the Department of Public Health in the state. You were a primary care physician at New York City's Bellevue Hospital.
That's right.
Imagine what that's like there now. And you were also a Fairhaven Community Healthcare. You were the medical director of quality improvement at the state. So in those various jobs, you dealt with public health. What can you think of something you learned or experienced there that's helping you now lead New Haven, help lead New Haven with Dr. Bond and the mayor through this public health crisis?
Yeah, I've learned so much in those different experiences, both from the clinical side and the policy side. So I think one of the most important lessons here is that how to get people aligned around a certain agenda, commit to actions, and making that happen quickly. And that's something I've learned over the years working, you know, ironically enough, in a bureaucracy, because in fact, the bureaucracy is the most challenging place to make that happen. You know, the idea that we need to respond and different pieces need to respond and they need to, you know, track what they're doing and report that back. I think that is a lesson that I've learned as being a public servant.
Can you think of a time you learned it when you saw it happen or not happen? Can you think of a story of a day where, boy, that worked, that really happened, or if we had just done that, we could have gotten it together?
Oh, that's such a great question. I don't think I can think of something off the top of my head.
I can.
You want to do it? Yeah.
Yeah, here's what it took.
20 years ago, my first day at work was the anthrax case in Oxford.
Yeah. Whoa, town of Oxford?
At the Naugatuck Valley Health District, I was hired as a community health outreach worker, and we were the only health department outside of Oxford that had nurses on staff, and we needed to literally quickly dispense medication to the town of Oxford. And so talk about timing. So here it is 20 years, almost 20 years later, and I am now dealing with, you know, coronavirus.
So what did you learn from that experience? I remember the anthrax. We were freaked out.
Remember
People were
that?
Scared to open mail. There were white powder shutdowns and fears and fake talcum powder placements just to freak everybody out.
And I think knowledge is power, and being able to have the facts provided to you and be socially responsible on basic prevention, because people were getting exposed to just things that can be, if you're alert, you can prevent. So like alertness of hand washing now has become something that's common.
And I'm hoping, like you said about making government work virtually in the new era, learning how to wash our hands. I'm learning this at 60. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and so he said at 60, I mean, yeah. Right. So, and so things like that is just, is important. And I think, information, I think right now in 2020, we have the ability to utilize like your Facebook Live right now. We didn't have that 20 years ago. And so it was really hard to get information out
and
in a timely way.
I'm saluting you folks on all the platforms you're using. I've been watching your videos. I've been reading
Thank
the stuff
you.
You're putting on the web.
Right.
I'm getting your calls. I'm getting your texts. I mean, you folks totally all on top of this idea that you have to go through multiple platforms. There's no one way.
There's no one way.
To reach everybody.
And the radio is also, traditional media is also important for older populations that, you know, do not want to engage in social platforms.
Okay, I knew this was going to happen. The questions are coming at the end of the show. Okay, Michelle Rodriguez. Should the city close their offices, and I apologize very much for interrupting there, I'm sorry. I'm trying to get some questions in before.
Sure,
should
no
the city close their offices that work directly with the public to ensure safety to its workers?
So I think that some of the services that the city provides are so critical to the everyday lives of individuals that is not a decision that we would take lightly, because it does cause significant disruption in people's lives. I think we would have to, if such a decision were to be made, it would have to be examined on a case-by-case scenario whether there was an actual risk to city employees or those who might come through City Hall. Right now, what we're encouraging, and we've posted signs all over the place at City Hall, is to practice basic hands-free precautions and reminders on basic sanitary precautions. We also have a facilities operations to make sure that the building is cleaned with appropriate cleaning sure. solutions and whatnot, and the elevator buttons are wiped and the doorknobs are wiped. All of that is in place. So
how often are the elevator buttons wiped?
I believe they're. Well, I don't know the
I
answer to that.
I can't answer
yeah,
that
I don't
question.
Know the, that's
I don't
a facilities
know.
Detail question. But
I can ask now.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask tomorrow morning just because
sometimes
of that.
I feel like an overreacting nut because when I'm at city government.
Use your elbow.
When I open the door is right by, at certain places, hand sanitizer. And I'm very embarrassed that I do this. After I open the door is when I use the hand sanitizer.
That's okay.
Yeah, and I think it's overreacting. Okay, so in something you can't
I don't think
so.
See, I do it.
We have two Facebook pages, one you can't see up there, that asks you, I'm wondering how public officials confront the skepticism people yeah. have. Because there is that other side. Everyone says, this is just the swine flu. Boy, you're reacting. I want my parade. Thank you for that question, by the way. How do you deal with the skepticism people have?
I think part of it is just continuing to get our message out there, coming on programs like yours. Mm-hmm. And continue to use a science-based and a data-based approach to inform the public about what this epidemic is about and what they can do about it. I think that is our role, and we are happy to answer any questions that come up regarding.
We're a pro-science yeah. zone. Christian John Gilson writes, thank you for listening, Christian John Gilson. I think probably a first-time commenter here on WNHH. Some insurance companies have vowed to pay for coronavirus mm-hmm. testing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm assuming, tricky word, that some people will experience some kind of financial loss because of this.
You know,
is the coronavirus a good case? Ooh, we're getting into the primary. For Medicare for all and mandated sick leave. We know that Rosa DeLauro, our congresswoman, has a bill to mandate paid sick leave and have the government, even President Trump, I mean, this is getting bipartisan here about reimbursing workers who can't get paid sick leave. What's your thought? And thank you for your question, Christopher.
Yeah, so our
policy implications.
Our delegation are working, as you just mentioned, Rosa DeLauro, along with Senator Blumenthal, are really advocating to ensure that this is not going to financially impact the community and the state. And so we are hoping that that as they are working through and contacting these different entities, that they remain committed so that this does not financially impact those affected by it.
Yeah, I do worry about folks who may bear a significant financial cost, either because they have to stay home from work and won't get paid, or they, even though the insurance companies may cover the testing, there are a lot of associated services that might go along with the testing.
I mean,
those
extra bills you get that you thought after you paid your first bill.
Exactly. So I would be very concerned about those folks, and any policies and platforms that would help address that, I think would be helpful.
Well, it's great to hear you weigh in on policy. Your jobs right now are very practical, hands-on. You're helping New Haven get ready
yes.
for dealing with this if and when the coronavirus hits us hard, which could be as we speak or not at all. Who knows? We hope not at all. So as we say goodbye, I want to ask you to tell our listeners three things they should do, where they should go online for info, what they should be doing in their lives right now.
So if you're experiencing any potential symptoms and, you know, have been exposed or think you have been exposed to coronavirus, first, you should contact your healthcare provider. And second, it can be your local health department. Of course, in New Haven, for those New Haven listeners, it would be our health department at 203-946-4949. We are also posting what you need to know on the newhavenct.gov website. They are very basic, how to get your household ready. They're also for specialized groups like the homeless that Dr. DeLau mentioned, daycare centers, long-term care facilities, and those of that nature. And then those that would like to visit the CDC has plenty of posters. So those of you that work in businesses that would like to have easy infographic posters, the Center for Disease Control at cdc.gov /coronavirus/2019 have lots of resources available and daily are updating their website also with the current status of this virus.
All right.
I think you covered it.
I think you both covered it, and I want to appreciate. I thank you so much for making the time today.
You're very welcome, Paul.
It was a real delight.
Thank you for having us.
It was a delight to meet you after editing many stories and cropping and writing captions to photos of the both of you. And you're just as wonderful in person as I was guessing from reading about
you.
I want to thank. So thanks for joining us. Thanks for the questions that people had. Thanks to Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support. And thanks to the miracle man behind the controls, getting us on platforms and universes and dimensions I will never even know exist. WNHH station manager Harry Dross. Thanks to Gage Frank for doing a little fact-checking here on the media. And we're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience, performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us all day and all night long at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.